Hello and welcome. You are listening to Tall Cat Psychic 101 on Station 1 right here on BBS Radio. Yeah, baby. Every other Monday, I aspire to inspire you. Now, we have an amazing guest for you guys tonight. You are going to want to hear everything Stephen has to say. Researching Stephen Swartz has been an adventure in itself. You know, one has the feeling of going down the online rabbit hole with your brain cells all jazzed and glittery, just researching what his life is about and what he's been into and what he's up to and what's going on with Stephen. He has spent his whole life exploring extraordinary human functioning, which has convinced him that life is interconnected and interdependent. His bio is impressive, and his sincerity will draw you to him. Just click on the info right next to the schedule, and you'll see the extent of his varied interests and accomplishments. Now, here's a few of the things that the Tall Cat found most amazing about Stephen, or Stephen. We'll find out which way we pronounce it. He worked in the White House during Watergate and has written speeches for military and political figures, including President Nixon. He used remote view to predict the details of Saddam Hussein's capture, to discover the palace of Mark Antony, the lighthouse of the pharaohs, shipwrecks from several centuries in the Alexandria Project. He proved, using rigorous scientific protocol, the existence of communication at a distance in Project Deep Quest. And he worked as a producer in film and television, PBS documentaries, regular TV dramatic series, and he publishes the well-known and very respected Swartz Report, which anyone can subscribe to on his website, swartzreport.net, and that's spelled S-C-H-W-A-R-T-Z, swartzreport.net. He is kind of one of the, I would say, the original guys, one of the original founders in remote view, right up there with Ingo Swann and all the others. He is a veteran of 7 years in a military RV program, and now he's
No, I never did classified research.
Okay, thank you. That's important. Thank you for correcting
me. That was important to me.
Yes, yes. He is working now to establish standards and to promote peaceful use of this tool. Welcome, Stephen.
Welcome to you, Karen. How are you?
I'm so happy to have you on the show. You know, I hope that tonight's show will help sort of bust up some of the more preposterous claims about RV and what it offers, and make it more accessible to ordinary people. Because I practice RV. I practice and I work at improving at it all the time. And I understand what you're talking about when you say that if you can daydream, you can remote view.
That's right.
But to begin with, I have a lot of email questions here, people wanting to ask questions of you. And one of the first things I guess we should start with is a definition, because several people ask for that, a definition of remote view.
Well, remote viewing, a term that was coined by a New York artist and very talented remote viewer, author named Ingo Swann. I originally called it distant viewing, but remote viewing is the term that has stuck. And it really shouldn't be called remote viewing. Actually, it ought to be called non-local awareness. But putting that aside, remote viewing is a protocol. It's a kind of skill set that allows you to open to that aspect of your consciousness, which is outside of space-time, and it allows you to get objectively verifiable information, not using your normal perceptual senses, but using this non-local aspect of consciousness, and to get sense impressions and a sense of knowingness. That is, it's as if in a daydream you could tell what something tasted like or smelt like or sounded like or what color it was or what texture it was, and you would also know things about it even though you wouldn't know how you knew. And remote viewing was just a very meticulously designed, we call them protocols, to obtain this information in a way that could not be explained by any other explanation. That is, you were asked to describe targets that were either physically very distant from you or from which you were shielded or that lay in the future or in the past that no one knew anything about, and only subsequent research would reveal the correct answer. So what we wanted, you know, let me go back and say that there are many different paths that teach us how to open to this part of ourselves. But not many of them, because of how they developed, are really specific about objectively verifiable information. But the point of, and the thing that distinguishes remote viewing from other kinds of visualization techniques is that you bring back and record and one can validate very, very specific information, just as if outside of your radio studio there were an accident and you ran outside and you talked to people who had witnessed it and you got answers from them, and not everything they said would be correct, and some people would be better at giving the description than other people. But if you interviewed a number of them, just like a reporter or a policeman would, you'd be able to reconstruct pretty well what happened at that accident that you couldn't possibly know anything about. And remote viewing is essentially the same thing.
Well, you know, when people hear what remote viewing, when they hear it described, it really requires, and at least in my opinion, it requires an experience with remote view to really kind of understand it, because
I agree.
It sounds in description, in word form, it sounds like that's impossible. I don't
believe
that.
That's right. I completely, Karen, you're absolutely correct. The only way you really get remote viewing is to remote view.
Yes.
And once you remote view, then you don't need to be told what the experience is like because you had it. But the closest, that's why I say that the closest approximation I can give you is that it's kind of like a fantasy or a daydream. You know, when you have a fantasy or a daydream, I mean, you don't actually see the thing. You kind of see it in your mind's eye. And you know, in your fantasy, in your daydream, you can make it any color you want, and it can be any shape you want, or whatever. Well, remote viewing is kind of like that, only instead of making it up, what you're doing is opening to a part of yourself. It's as if you had a wing of a house that you lived in that you hadn't previously gone to, and suddenly you saw a door, and you opened that door, and you went in, and wow, look at all that. Well, once you have that experience, then if I say to you, do you have that wing on your house, you know, of course, I've had the experience.
Yes.
So the experience is what really matters.
Well, you know, when I teach remote view, and I don't teach it, of course, with as much expertise and as much protocol as you have, I do it sort of in a relaxed, very informal, casual setting.
And that's the way to do it.
What I decided to try to do is just teach it the way I learned it. And I did not put anything out in front of the people, very much even of the word remote view. I sort of taught them to,
right.
I got them into a state of meditation, and I told them to view what dropped down on the screen in front of their eyes. And afterwards, we discussed about what remote view is. And what surprised me the most about it, and still does to this day, and I'm sure you know what I'm talking about, is that it's so often the most skeptical, and often the men who were there, like because their wives or girlfriends wanted them to come, that have amazing hits.
Yeah, <that's laughs>
you always
true.
Get a kick out of that.
That's true. And the reason is that because their intellectual mind has no idea what the experience is going to be like, they don't know how to psychologically guard against it. We call that the first-time effect. There in the research literature, there are any number of reports that the first remote viewing a person does is often the best they do for a long time. In fact, the difference between a naive remote viewer, that is somebody who's brand new to it, and a person who's been doing it for a long time is not that they get better, although they may get better for reasons that I'll explain in a minute, but principally it's that experienced remote viewers are consistent. It's consistency that makes the difference. If you look at the experimental record of most people, it looks like a square root sign. You remember that from school? It looks kind of like a there's a little line, and then there's a big dip, and then it comes back up again and then goes over, right?
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's kind of what the research data looks like for viewers. They have several powerful initial experiences, and then their analytical mind says, whoa, wait a minute, you can't do this. You can't look at the future. You can't describe somebody 3,000 miles away. This is crazy. And there's a big drop. And the protocol, the methodology for doing it, it's like learning any kind of skill set, you know, like learning to play an instrument, or it's not that hard, but you have to learn to trust this part of yourself, and then your ability comes back up again, and you go on, and it's consistency. When I was running the Mobius Laboratories, which was the lab that I ran for 20 years, I had a whole set of people who, about 16, who regularly participated in the archaeology experiments, and then we tested about 25,000 people. And what we saw over and over again was this same patterning that I'm describing. Some people take it on and they want to learn it because it has other applications. You know, it's useful in, for instance, creatively solving things. It allows you to open up to information about your future, for instance. You can go down your own timeline. I've recently created a CD called Looking Into Your Future that does exactly just what I'm describing. You can use it to solve criminal problems. People do it that way. They find geological resources. They use it for financial reasons. I developed a protocol called Associated Remote Viewing many years ago, in which you ask people to describe an object, say an apple, and you associate the apple with a particular outcome. If they describe an apple, the stock market will go up. If they describe a banana, the stock market will go down. And so you don't ask people whether the stock market will go up or down. You ask them, I'm going to show you a fruit in a little while. I want you to describe it to me. And they say, well, it's, you know, it's round and red and has a little twig at the top, and, you know, it's an apple. It's much easier for people to do that in certain circumstances than it is to give analytical information like, will the stock market go up and down? But you can learn to open to this part of yourself, and it changes the way you look at the world.
Well, you know, the reason it's so why it's true that it's easy to learn remote view and can be learned in as little as 5 minutes is because we already know how to do it. Isn't that right?
Well, yes. I mean, we don't know how to do remote viewing as a protocol, but we always are processing this aspect of our consciousness. It's just that it normally occurs below conscious awareness. It's very hard to understand this when you think in terms of signals and senders and receivers, and that people are sending something or receiving. That's not what's going on. That's a kind of radio model. What's happening is that this is not rare. This is not anomalous. It's not a cult. It's none of those things. Those are all just ways of approaching it. This is an aspect of human consciousness that all humans have got to some degree or another, or at least they permit themselves to have it to some degree or another, and that all other beings do too, because the research shows that all life is interconnected and interdependent. So what you're learning to do is to open to a part of yourself. Think of it in another way. Suppose you lived in a world where everybody was colorblind, and you suddenly could see red. How would you describe that to somebody? I saw red. What does that mean? Well, it's this kind of hot color, and why is it hot? I mean, you see what the question.
Yes.
If nobody else could see red, and you say, well, I can see red, how would you explain that? Well, it wouldn't mean anything to them because they had never experienced color, so the world to them looked completely different. And that's what it's like to remote view. When you wake up, to this ability in yourself, and you come to experience it so that you believe that you can do it, as opposed to somebody, you know, telling you that, you know, you can do it. You can do it. Once you've had that experience, then you begin to say, well, geez, there's other parts of myself that I can explore, and it's quite empowering for most remote viewers, and it does not require any particular, you don't have to believe in anything, it doesn't require that you join any school, it's not hard to learn, mostly it's about practicing it, you don't have to follow any guru, it's a technology of the mind, like a kind of mental yoga or a modern mental martial art.
I love the way you describe it, like mental yoga or a modern-day martial art, because when I practice remote view and when I see other people do it, I think the best part about it is when you go toward it in a sort of a playful, relaxed kind of a way,
right,
and let it unfold without a lot of pressure about I have to
right.
be right and, you know, what if I'm wrong.
Right.
And
exactly.
Some techniques I've seen it taught a few times where it was rather stiff and kind of there was an expectation, unspoken expectation.
Oh, yeah.
You know,
yeah,
and it's a shame that that happened.
You are correct, Karen, that is the way to approach it. Now, there's all kinds of, you know, people will take thousands of dollars from you to teach you how to do a version of it. But the truth is, I mean, I've looked at thousands of people that have done this. It's actually kind of fascinating. It's like watching someone daydream. You know, I've actually been very honored because you don't often let somebody sit across the table from you and watch you while you daydream. You know, it's socially we don't do that. But
yes.
When you do a remote viewing session with a monitor, a person asking questions, and they ask questions that don't contain the answer, so they don't cue you in any way, they just want to keep you talking. When you sit there across from somebody, it's very intimate, and they're describing, I'm in this place, and you say to them, okay, look down at your feet, what do you see? And they describe it, just as if they were there. You know, when I do a remote viewing session, I would say to you, Karen, I want you to go forward in time, whatever the time is, and you're at the locale that we're seeking, and your life size, what do you see? Look down at your feet, look to your left, look to your right, look straight ahead. Go up into the air about 18 feet so that you have a panorama. What is it you see? Are there other people present? Can you hear anything? Can you smell anything? And people answer all of those kinds of questions. And when you look at their descriptions and then ask judges, for instance, to compare them against other places, it's very obvious. Or if you're doing an applications experiment, then the information they give you provides the field directions for the subsequent field work. If it's an archaeological site, you know, and someone tells you to go 3,000 miles away and look for the hill that has a big rock that's shaped like an Indian head and there's a tall tree and six paces to the left from the rock and the tall tree, you dig down 3 feet and you're going to find the buried city. I mean, if you do that and there is such a hill and there is such a big rock and there is, you go that space away and you dig down and you find the buried building, I mean, it cuts through an awful lot of skepticism.
Oh, it certainly does. And I've often seen people have what you described, I think, as a reality vertigo.
Right,
once
people
they
go into
actually,
reality vertigo. That's right.
Once they encounter this validation, and I find remote view so exciting because of the work that I do as a psychic medium. I want people to know that everybody has this ability to know.
Well, you're doing a kind of remote viewing. I mean,
yes.
You're just doing it in a different context.
Exactly.
That's why I say it really shouldn't be called remote viewing. What it really ought to be called. I mean, remote viewing is a term that got cooked up, I don't know, 35 years ago, whatever it is. And when we had very different understanding, today I would call it non-local awareness. And you can experience non-local awareness, that is, that aspect of yourself that is not local to your brain. That is, it's not, you know, it's something outside of the normal physiological processes. if you can do that, then you are opening to this aspect of yourself, and all the senses report, and sometimes they come via a personality, because in non-local awareness, all the fields that represent all of the people there ever were, they're all in there, and you can contact that, or you know, there are many ways to do this. That's what I've learned after 35 years, some of my viewers see themselves as dowsers, some of them see themselves as mediums, some of them see themselves as remote viewers. Doesn't matter.
And I think you said, too, that I loved how you said this. I hope I'm quoting it correctly, that there's really only one mountain in town, and how you get up there is up to you.
Well, there's only one mountain in town, and it's an illusion. Because
yes.
What we're coming to learn is that consciousness is causal. Materiality is its manifestation. So the mountain, I mean, Buddhism has been telling us this for years. The mountain's an illusion, but how you get up it depends on your state of consciousness and your point of view. And there are lots of ways to do it, but all of it is about awakening.
And you know what?
Awaken to yourself.
And this is the important piece. And also, you know, Stephen, what you're doing is putting the information out there. And I know that this is becoming RV is becoming a lot more understood by mainstream people, but there's still a little bit of residual, in my opinion anyway, that RV is, sort of has something to do with psychic spies, and, you know, it's...
Oh, yes, that's most unfortunate. That's because, that's why I didn't do classified research. I mean, people make different decisions, so I don't criticize anybody, but I was offered the chance to do classified research, essentially kind of remote viewing spying, and I didn't want to do it because I thought that years hence, exactly has happened, that it would become associated with spying. And that's not an association that I find particularly happy. I would much prefer that people think about this as opening to an aspect of themselves which allows them to make compassionate, life-affirming decisions because they have a new kind of awareness. And so when I was offered money to do that kind of work, I turned it down, even though that was hard to do.
I'm sure. Well, you know, the opening yourself up to the infinite, as the title of your book says, is really the most important piece, because that's where the empowerment comes from, and that's where your skill to use this RV to apply to your everyday life, your personal life, what's going on in the world. There's all kinds of creativity within there for solutions, inventions, creations. It applies to all aspects of life, doesn't it?
Absolutely. In fact, I have just created a 4-CD set called Crisis Conduct. And in fact, we're going to launch it tomorrow, but I think you might be able to get to it through crisisconduct.com. But I've taken 4 CDs, one called Before the Beginning, which is takes you back to the moment that you decided to be you before you were incarnate.
Wow.
And why you decided to be you. And it's based on visualization and regression research that's been done. In fact, all of this stuff, I have put together 3 bibliographies, one on meditation, one on remote viewing, and one on healing that really give the scientific basis for these CDs. But one's called Before the Beginning. That's why you decided to be you. What's the point of your life?
Oh,
very helpful
love
for
that.
People. Yeah.
Awesome. Awesome.
The second one is called Meditation for Modern Minds, and it is a technique of meditation which is specifically designed for people who have grown up in and live in a high technology, stressful society, because some people, not everybody, there are many ways to meditate, and I encourage people, whatever works, that's what you need to do, and do it regularly, every day. But I have designed a technique which has been particularly useful for people who live in a modern society, because some people find the techniques which developed in an earlier age before any of this stuff existed, when things moved at a much slower pace and there was much less stimulation and it was much easier to focus because mm-hmm. there wasn't so much demanding counter interests. So meditation for modern minds is a technique for modern people.
I was just going to say that in order to remote view, if you are going to develop the skill and improve at it, it does require some consistent application of meditation and the ability to focus, which, as you were just saying, in today's society, that does not happen really particularly naturally. You almost have to seek it out.
Yes, that's right. You have to work at it. It's a technique. And it's an easy technique. So anyway, that's the third one is about that, and a second one's about that. Then the third one is called healing, and it's really about stimulating your body's immune response.
And it's
it's based on all kinds of placebo studies and about psychophysical self-regulation, because we know that people have the ability to control their bodily functions down to the cellular level. I mean, there's lots of, but that's why placebo works.
Yes.
The people that get the sugar pill, 35% of them on average do as well or better than the people that get the medication. The only way that can happen is that individuals have the ability to control their bodily functions down to the cellular level. That's what makes placebo work. So healing is about stimulating your own immune response and about sending healing out to others, because there are thousands of studies now that show that the consciousness of one person can have a therapeutic effect on the well-being of another organism. And the fourth CD is called Looking Into Your Future, and it's about looking into your future. You pick a time in the future that you would like to know about, and it takes you through the process to have that experience. So these are four experiences which are designed together to provide a toolkit for people in positions of stress and challenging times.
You know, they're so perfect. Those are perfect for people right now. That's genius.
And you don't have to join any religion. You don't have to, you can be anything you want to be. It doesn't matter. That's not what I'm trying to do. I'm just trying to take laboratory research and put it together in a way that a normal person can utilize these skills so that they can take control of their lives.
And, you know, people are desperately need this. People are hurting out there. These CDs you're speaking of, to me, just could not be more timely and more perfectly directed toward the overall what's going on the planet right now.
Well, crisis conduct, I did this because of all the people who have written me saying, you know, I've lost my job, I can't do this, my kids have, I can't afford to keep them in school. I feel like my life is completely out of control. How can I get some kind of control in my life? And so I created them for that purpose.
Oh, they're awesome. You know, I got your remote view CD for looking into your own future.
Right.
And I went through it just a little bit one night. In fact, just researching for you before the show, I have to say you are truly so interesting that you create insomnia. I have had so much fun reading.
I'm sorry to hear that.
Writing. It's okay. It's all worth it. But I listened to part of your CD about looking into your own future, and I was just sort of playing around with it because I was, you know, taking notes at the time, and I sort of fell into it and dropped in, and I stood there and looked at my feet with the focus of where we were going to live because we're moving, and we had a contract on a particular house, and when I looked up at the door of the house, as you instructed, it wasn't the door of the house we had the contract on, and I said, well, that's interesting. It's completely different. Tall glass doors, two double doors instead of wood. And it was only maybe 24 hours and the contract fell through and another one came up and the house we'll be living in has two tall glass doors.
Oh, wow. That's wonderful. Oh, I love stories like that. Will
yeah,
you write me that? Will you send me an email and tell me that?
I absolutely will.
Oh, I love stories like this. This is my payback for creating it. I just love to get these stories.
I'd be happy to send it to you.
Oh, yes. Oh, that's so interesting, and it's so typical.
Yes.
It's so, people, you know, you're an experienced voyager into non-local awareness, but for someone who's never done it before, I mean, when you do something like that, it's a real grabber.
Oh, it's a thrill. It's still a thrill to me, and I'll never stop enjoying seeing other people encounter this. Another interesting fact I found, one time I was asked to help with a police case to find a body. And when I'm asked, I do try to help with that. And the first thing I'd like to say about that is that using remote view, when you are working in that particular, as you say, protocol, it seems to, in my case, I feel so neutral that I don't find myself experiencing the emotional upset of it because I'm just there to report.
That's exactly how it is designed, because...
It's great for that, and the other amazing part...
Absolutely. A lot of people find it, it's hard to look at murders.
Oh.
For people who do criminological work, Catherine Harwig, you do this. There's a handful of people. I've written about this. In fact, in Opening to the Infinite, my latest book, I wrote about this. I have a lot of respect for the people that do this because you look at, first of all, they have a good track record, and second of all, when you think about what they're doing to solve a crime... to go back and witness somebody's murder or something. I mean, that's pretty heavy duty.
Very. And, in this particular case, I really wanted to help, and I did find that at some points in certain cases, I got a lot of static information that was not accurate or not helpful. And this time I wanted to zone in really accurately and really just hit it really quickly. So I thought I'm going to experiment. My intention that I sent out before I viewed was that I would actually receive information that the police would be interested in.
Like
an address.
Right. You don't want to get emotionally engaged. You want to get actionable information. And what you did, Karen, I mean, you're just a natural at this. You see, it's spread through the population like a bell curve. There's a few people that are Tiger Woods at one end, and there are a few people who just don't get it at the other end, and most of the people fall somewhere in the middle. That's why it's a bell curve. But for people who are gifted at this, they have an instinct for it. They learn how to control this part, and the remote viewing protocol is designed, just as you say, to give you some emotional distance so that you're just reporting. You're not engaging. It gives you some capacity for emotional distance, which is very important in these sorts of things. Did it work out? I mean, did the police follow up? Did good things happen?
It did. The most amazing part of it was that I think you'll appreciate, since I went into it playfully saying, okay, my intention is something that the police would really like, and, really would be helpful, like addresses and locations. And you know what I received was the location was in a small park area with a bridge over a small amount of water, and it was the zip code was one number. The last number of the zip code was one number higher than where she lived, and it was located at between two streets that were numbers, like the 21st and 32nd Avenue.
Right.
And she was easily recovered, and it was very quick.
Great.
My result from that was, it was a murder, and I don't mean to be inappropriate about it, but I really was very neutral about this, and the playful aspect of it felt really good.
Well, you did the right thing. I mean, first of all, you did the critical first thing. What we know about this is that intention is what drives it.
I learned
that. So forming a part of the protocol of remote viewing is forming a clear intention. And what you did when you said, I don't want to have an emotional experience, I want to get actionable information, you created the intention contract for that experience.
Love that word, intention contract.
If you think of this as a kind of bio circuit, think of it, I always think of it anyway, as kind of like a computer motherboard, and it's got chips plugged in. And that's the policeman and the person who gets murdered and the person who does the murder and the remote viewer, and all those people have a kind of shared linkage like chips on the motherboard. There's a circuit that's created, and the circuit you join the circuit as the viewer because of your intention to obtain actionable information.
And that's all I'm there for.
That's right. But it's holding the intention and being able to do that clearly and without getting dragged off into collateral, maybe interesting, but essentially collateral issues, staying focused. We know that basically three things matter in remote viewing. Intention, numinosity. Numinosity means the more people have been aware of this, of whatever it is, the more strongly emotion has been present, the easier it is for the remote viewer to see. And the third part is where there is entropic process, that is, where there is a transition from one state to another state. It could be nuclear energy in a reactor. It could be solar panels on a solar generator. It could be a murder where there is a transition of consciousness, right? What's important in non-local consciousness is that that there be a transition of some sort, because this makes it more numinous. And by numinous, I mean it has a kind of, it's a kind of field, a kind of charge on it. There's a lot of research, for instance, that has shown that, for instance, I just saw a paper on logos done by a man named Robert Shorn, in which he showed that those logos that are better known and that have been viewed more often under more emotional circumstances become much easier for people to see than logos that are fake logos that just get made up and you show them, for instance, in another country where they wouldn't know it was a logo, and yet if it's a real logo, they'll pick it up right away, and if it's not, then they'll pick it up more slowly. I mean, there are a number of studies like this that show that the greater the emotional awareness, particularly where heightened emotion is present, the easier it is for a remote viewer to see that. And the reason I think that remote viewers tend to have actually a pretty good record all about murders is that it is an extremely emotional, transitional, highly numinous experience. And there is a very strong intention amongst successful viewers because they want to solve it. They want justice to be done. They want to get actionable information. And I think that's why it works so well, because the two things that are really interesting that lots of people do is successfully is the criminal work, and people do intuitive diagnosis very well. That is, they can look at another person and go over their bodies sort of mentally and they catch places where people have experienced injury. And there are a number of researchers that have written about this. And Judith Orloff has written quite a bit
this,
for instance.
I just met her recently at a book signing. She is amazing.
Oh, she's wonderful.
Amazing.
She's a Mobius remote viewer.
She is.
One of my remote viewers for years and years, yeah.
Oh, she's just such a beautiful person.
Absolutely.
Beautiful, beautiful person. Awesome, awesome lady. Most interesting. I really recommend all of her books and her teachings. And if anybody ever has a chance to meet her, please do. Because she's just incredible. I didn't know she remote viewed. That's wonderful.
As she talks about it in, I think, her first book, Second Sight, describes our relationship and working in the lab. We've been very good friends for a long time. Larry Dossey's another one. Larry's got a new book out called Premonitions that addresses this issue of non-local consciousness. And, you know, in my book, Opening to the Infinite, there increasingly science is beginning to grapple with the reality of this aspect of consciousness.
Well, it's a timely, it's a good time for this to be coming forward, and that's one reason I'm so happy to have you on the show talking about this, because if there was ever a time this is a very interesting time to be alive altogether in every way. But
absolutely.
These particular skills, and from what I've sensed, and what I believe is that once in the future, in the not too distant future, these type of skills and beyond this type of skill are going to be considered commonplace.
Well, they're definitely going to become, I think, much more prevalent. We know, for instance, that from research that chief executive officers of corporations, as an example, have a strong capacity for precognitive remote viewing. And in fact, it's such a strong correlation that Douglas Dean and John Michalowski, who did research with 385 CEOs, the correlation was so strong they could look at the balance sheet of the corporation and describe in advance how the guy who was going to take the test was going to do, because, as they said, profits make profits. And if you think about it, it's exactly the same thing as a hunter-gatherer culture 30,000 years. This is where it comes from. You know, back in the beginning of time, as it were, hunter-gatherer family groups would go around, and those guys who had a stronger capacity to be able to remote view where the gazelle was, to know where the gazelle was going to be tomorrow, their people ate, and their family survived, and their genes were perpetuated. And those people who weren't able to do that successfully, well, they died out. They starved to death, and their genes didn't get perpetuated. And so, yeah, get stumbled in those P's.
Yes, too many P's.
Yeah, so this is a part of evolutionary survivalism. I mean, we selected for it because, as I say, those guys who were able to do it, they ate well. Today, the modern hunter-gatherer warrior is the chief executive officer of a corporation. The corporation's like a big family group. And the role of the CEO is to position his company, so that in the future, because he has to plan several years in advance, it takes a long time to move a big corporation in a direction. So you have to plan years in advance, and the whole game is to position yourself so that you're where the zeitgeist is at some point in the future. And I'll give you an example that's just as obvious as it can be. Steve Jobs and the iPod and Apple, for instance, the idea of personal communication stuff, they started doing it and they perfected it. Or another one is Toyota, as opposed to the American automobile manufacturers. I mean, the executives of Toyota decided to make the commitment to hybrids very early on. And, you know, the Prius is now one of the most popular cars in the world.
That's what we drive.
Yeah.
My husband and I have Prius. You know,
that's right, and that's because 8 years ago or so, some guy said, you know, in the future, we need to be positioned for XYZ. We've got to design this car, and they did. And when you suddenly awakened to ecological issues, it became important. Gas prices went up. Lo and behold, there was a car to step into.
Yeah, so interesting. You know, speaking of the evolutionary part of all this, I know you're working on something called the 2050 Project, and I can't tell you how many emails and how much communication I get from people that are concerned about the changes. There's a lot of fear promotion, unfortunately, out there. And
yeah.
And yet there is, we are in an emerging evolutionary time, and
yeah.
People are concerned about where to live, where to move. You know, there is a migration that seems to be happening, and so what I get from people so often is what's coming up in the years before 2012, what's after 2012, and is there a good place to live?
Well,
safe place to live.
Yeah, I mean, there's several answers I'll give you. One is, your listeners, if you want to get my sense of what's lying in the future, you want to go to www.explorejournal.com and then click on Schwartz Report when you get to the homepage there. And that'll take you to all my essays that I write in the journal Explore. And I cover these trends that are shaping the future. And then day to day, I publish the Schwartz Report at www.schwartzreport.net. So I have been tracking trends that are shaping the future. I personally believe that 2012, again, let's go back to the earlier part of the conversation, 2012 is an event date because it represents some kind of highly numinous transition. Maybe it's the tip point for global warming, very possible. Maybe it's some kind of cataclysmic event. Something happens in 2012 that is so powerful that people have been precognizing it for 1,000 years and more.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they didn't know how to understand it, but they recognized that something was going on that was going to be the end. It's not the end of the world. It's the end of a world.
Mm-hmm.
We are going through a transition. Now, hold on just a minute. I'm sorry, we are in deep pollen country here in
Virginia. Oh, I understand.
I have pine pollen coming down so thick that it looks like I've been spray painting everything yellow. My car,
oh,
if you leave it out for an hour or two. Anyway, we know from the 2050 data that we survive. That's one thing. And we also have begun to get a pretty good sense of what it's going to be like. I'm still collecting this data, and I'm inputting it into a computer as we speak, having it input. And I'm going to, I'm then going to do an analysis of it and publish something on it. But I will say that the 2050s so far have been highly accurate. They describe the fall of the Soviet Union, and they describe the rise of AIDS. They describe the rise of virtual reality and Skyping.
Wow.
And so I have considerable faith in what they say about the future. And I will just say that we survive, the world doesn't end. There are definitely going to be massive changes. And I, as I say in the essays that are at explorejournal.com, I've written, for instance, about the migrations that I think are going to come. There are three big migrations that are already beginning. One is the migration out of the Southwest because of drought,
mm-hmm.
because water is destiny, and water is going to become a huge, huge issue later in this century. You can't overemphasize it. About a third of the human race is dependent on the Himalayan glacier hydrology, and that's all going to melt. And then all those people, about 2.4 billion people, are tied in. Then rivers like the Ganges and the Yangtze, those rivers are going to revert to little streams.
Mm-hmm.
Because, I mean, these are ancient, you know, the great rivers of the world, but they're fed by Himalayan glaciers. And the glaciers are melting.
Yes.
In the United States, in Montana, at Kalispell, Montana, where the Glacier National Park is, I mean, the rangers are telling people that in about 35 years, the glaciers may be gone.
Mm-hmm.
So when they melt, they release a tremendous amount of water, so there's flooding at first, and then there is drought. And we're going to have massive drought. About 60% of the United States is in some kind of drought condition right now.
Yes.
And I think we're going to see massive migrations out of the Southwest as water just becomes an impossible issue. That's one thing. The
mm-hmm.
second migration, I believe, is going to be the migration away from the coasts as seawater rises and as storms become more intense. And it's going to be driven by a lot of things. One is that it's going to become extremely difficult if you live on the coast to get insurance because the insurance carriers just won't cover it when they recognize what the real risk factor is. And you can already see this happening along the Mississippi Delta, for instance.
Oh, yes.
And along the Florida coast. There are places you just can't get insurance, or you can only get it at an exorbitant cost. So one of the migrations is going to be away from the coast. And, you know, 54% of the American population lives within 100 kilometers, that's about 70 miles, of a coastline. or within land that lies less than 10 meters high, so that's very small, very low rise. And as the water levels go up, cities like New York or Washington or Baltimore are going to have terrible problems.
Mm-hmm.
If you go to the University of Arizona Geosciences Department's animated maps about water rise, you can see, I mean, they have maps and they show you 1 meter, 2 meter, 3 meter, 4 meter, 5 meter. You can see what's going to happen, and it's going to become increasingly obvious over the next 30 years. So I think there's going to be a big migration away from the coasts. And the third migration is going to be the migration into the now largely abandoned middle states. The European farming experiment has essentially failed. That is, family farms of 160 acres. You can't do that anymore. You can't make that work. So families have either cobbled together much larger holdings or corporate industrial agriculture is going on, or some hybrid involving private farmers and corporate agricultural interests. So as a result of that, the population dropped in the center of the states enormously to less than, in some places, one person per 10 square miles, which was defined by the Census Bureau as desolate lands.
Wow.
But that is now going to reverse, with the information revolution now well in hand. People near cities are going to move back into small towns because it's cheaper and it's a nicer place to raise your kids and you don't have to go in. People are going to leave. It won't be as necessary to live close to an urban area. I think some people from the suburbs are going to move into the urban areas. That's already happening. And some are going to move away into small towns. And happily, the abandoned central states, North Dakota's got a population that's smaller than, I don't know, Phoenix? Probably a lot smaller than Phoenix. I just don't happen to remember, but it's pretty small. But people are going to start moving back in because that wind corridor is going to be the green transition Saudi Arabia of wind energy. And a huge manufacturing of the infrastructure, the assemblage of the infrastructure, like the building of the interstate highways, is going to occur as these wind things go up. And already farmers who are libertarians by inclination are banding together, who would have thought it, to create wind combines. So they sell wind rights, just like they in the 20s and 30s in Oklahoma and Texas, they sold oil rights.
Yes, I have heard about that.
So we're going to see a lot of movement of population going on in this century. So a lot of the world that we have grown up in is going to change in pretty significant ways.
I think that, people talk about an awakening, and my thought on that is, calling it an awakening would be maybe the world's biggest understatement.
Oh, absolutely. Enormous fortunes are going to be made, Karen. Enormous fortunes.
Yes, true. Yes, yes.
Every time humanity has made an energy transition, enormous fortunes, particularly in the United States, have been made. For instance, from sail to steam with side wheelers, those old ships where the wheel was on the side of the ship that were stoked by wood, to steam driven by shafts, the modern form of driving a ship fueled by coal and coal trains to petroleum, diesel-powered ships, diesel-powered trains. Every time that kind of transition had occurred, huge fortunes get made. That's where the Rockefeller money came from, for instance.
Well, that's the creative part that people tend to overlook. They get caught in the disaster, and they forget that these changes are going to bring about amazing creativity.
That's right, and that trickles down into the middle class, just like Henry Ford's making Model Ts allowed the middle class to arise in the United States and to have mobility. So
absolutely,
the green transition is going to is going to transform the economics of the country in the most profound ways. Most of them good, by the way.
Yes, you know, Stephen, I hate to say that we're out of time because I could keep you here for 2 hours, and I hope that you'll join me again sometime because I haven't even begun to get into some of the things I'd love to talk to you about. And I know
Call me, we'll do another one.
Yes, I would love that. So it was a great show, though. I so enjoyed chatting with you, and I know that my listeners did as well. And so I'm going to remind everybody, be sure to tune in next Monday evening for Galexis for the Path of Power. And I'll be back on Monday, May 11th, with Miriam Delicato, who is the author of Alien Blue Star, Blue Star Fulfilling Prophecy. Miriam actually communicates with ET intelligence, and she has a lot to say about the times we live in. I want to add that she's one of the few grounded people that I know of that talks to ETs. Well, Stephen, thanks again for stopping by, and I look forward to speaking with you again.
My pleasure, Karen. You have a wonderful evening.
Thank you. You too. That's all for now, everybody. I'm going to send you out with a little bit of Shambhala. Bye now.
Wash away my trouble, wash away my pain, when the rain jumps out of love. Wash away my trouble, wash away my shame, when the rain jumps out of love. Tell my brother by the flowers in his eyes, all